All right, you want to start? All right. These folks now need no introduction, except there is one person additional that you may not have heard from. Would you like to introduce either yourself, or would you like to be introduced by somebody on the panel that might be related to you? How would you like to do that?
Okay, guys, so this is Huda. This is my daughter. I was telling you guys the story about, so this is the star.
Can we give her a round of applause? Okay, well, I heard one very good question. Do you want to start?
Okay. Actually, I have two questions. So for you, please, Jinan, I like Islam Bukhari, and I was laughing when you talked about, I love him too. And I was wondering, do you know any place where they support the work he does? What I like about Islam Bukhari is that he challenges the traditional narrative of like the extreme Muslims, who is kind of dominating a lot of the Muslim world, by the tradition, like by interpreting the Quran deeply and not by debating it. And this is what I like. So do you know anyone who's supporting something like this in the US? And the other question is for Ali, and it's how much do you think the secular Muslims contributed to the, may I call it, the anti-Muslim bigotry, because they're very invisible. So kind of like people here or in the West know the extreme Muslims more than the very secular or light Muslims in a way or another.
Do you want me to start?
Yeah.
Islam Bukhari is a very interesting figure, and a very important figure, because he's an example of what we call the public intellectual. And by public intellectual, I mean it's somebody who starts out with a particular specialization and then becomes very interested in the large questions of his society, moves out of his specialization, and tries to enlighten. So I think one of the ways that we can possibly help him is he's got a YouTube video, so you could possibly, and a Twitter feed, so you could possibly go on to his website. There may be places where you can actually donate. I think what we need to do in this country is to amplify his message and let people know about his program, because it really is like a college education about fiqh and what he's doing on YouTube. So I would really do that. And I think another thing that we all really need to be doing is Islam Bukhari swore that when he got up, there was two mistakes that he made that he would never repeat again. That when he was the victim of defamation, that he just let them talk. And he said after he got out of jail that if anybody ever says that he wrote something or said something or did something that cannot be documented, that he was going to use the court system to make them accountable for what they say. Because remember, these people are becoming very powerful by spreading rumors. The people who went out when Salman Rushdie wrote his book had not read his book. They hear one or two sheikhs saying that it is sacrilegious. The Egyptian secular writer Farag Foda in 1992 was assassinated. The person who assassinated him in court was asked, why did you do it? Did you read his books? He said, I don't know, I'm illiterate. And Farag Foda himself, before he was assassinated, wrote and said that there was a coordinated campaign of spreading rumors. So we have to really amplify the voices of these people who are doing far more courageous work than we are, because they're inside. And I'm going to try to find out, I'm going to try to contact him and find out more information, but I think, you know, donating so that these people can continue to have their YouTube, and if there are cases, donating to get lawyers to defend these people, because we have to go the legal route.
Oh, can you repeat it? So I think your question, if I'm framing it correctly, is you're saying did how much did secular Muslims contribute to the rise of the far right?
Yes, because we don't really speak, and for the West, it's mainly, if we're not visible or we don't speak as secular Muslims, then the Muslims are the bad ones. And not
right. So how much is the silence of the secular Muslims and the fact that we didn't speak up contribute to the rise? I think that's a really good question. That's actually honestly something that I hadn't thought about before. What I get a lot is the opposite. They say that because you're speaking up and you're criticizing Islam, you've empowered all of the anti-Muslim bigots. It's because, you know, they as if like somehow I'm responsible for it. And I always tell them, I'm like, ISIS and Al-Qaeda, they don't know me, but they know the Quran and Hadith really well, and that's what they quote. So I think that if secular Muslims were more visible, I think if they spoke out more, that would go a long way in not only normalizing the idea that there are people who dissent from the religion in the Muslim world, you know, that just like every other religious community has its, you know, dissidents and its, you know, reform-minded people. Of course, obviously, this population, 1.6 billion people, has to have theirs too. And when that makes them more visible, I think it'll also humanize, create more empathy for Muslims as well. So I think it's a very important thing for us to speak out and for us to talk about things. Because it does allow dissent and criticism, but at the same time, it prevents the actual anti-Muslim hate. That's
and are Muslims only atheists and ex-Muslims, or do you have like believers also?
This is probably this. Oh, one of you guys.
Yes, I mean, on behalf of Muslimish, it's an organization that is inclusive of questioning Muslims, former Muslims, Muslims with different degrees of religiosity, as long as they are tolerant and open and participate in creating a safe environment for the exchange of opinions. No?
Please, go for it.
Hi.
Be shy.
So first question is for any of the panelists. How do you make sure in what ways have you actively tried to prevent your movement from being co-opted by the alt-right and from anti-Islamic folks? It seems like you've had a lot of nuance, a lot of panelists have really moving stories, so this isn't just like dismissing the movement, but like there are probably people who point to and said, look, Islam is violent, Islam is not working for Muslims. How do you try and address that narrative? The second question is for you, Ali, specifically. I was really taken back by your assertion that most stories of Muslim women having their hijab taken off are probably like fabricated based on that one event in Toronto. CARE, the Southern Law Poverty Center, a lot of people have documented that there is a rising amount of hate crimes against Muslims. I'm just wondering if you think that is fabricated or if you just think that anecdotally, based on your experiences, most Muslim women are coerced to wear the hijab. That hasn't been my experience as an American Muslim. In fact, I know a lot of young Muslim women who have chosen to wear the hijab against the wish of their parents because they see it as a political statement in the U.S.
Right. So thanks for asking that question, because maybe I wasn't as clear as I should have been, is that there are several cases of women being attacked by the hijab that have come out. One was, I think, in Germany. There was one in France. There were a few in the U.S. And most of them turned out to those specific incidents, and there are just a handful of them. One of them was basically, it turned out that it didn't happen. She had returned home from late from, I think, when she was out with her friends. So she wanted to tell her parents, and she kind of told them that story, that she was attacked with the hijab. So in most of these cases, most of the cases that were reported, specifically about being attacked for the hijab, they actually turned out to be false. And that's not to say that anti-Muslim crimes don't happen, that's not to say that people have not been attacked for the hijab. There are absolutely cases where people have been attacked. I told you myself that not only do I get apart from the death threats and everything else that you get from religious or fundamentalist Muslims, I also get enough people telling me that they look at me as Muslims, like, get out of the country, you're a dirty terrorist, you know, you don't belong here, and so on. So I know that that's real, and I know that anti-Muslim hate crimes are on the rise, but I was speaking about these specific incidents in which there's a disproportionately high number that did turn out.
Do you have
statistical
evidence to back that up? Because I think that
not at the top of my head, but there are many. If you
press tends to like publicize, which makes sense, when women lie, right?
Right.
Because it's like sensational, because it seems like it's not happening. happening, but statistically, it seems like pretty ridiculous to extrapolate from that most of those cases are fabricated.
I think if you look
can
at...
Can I speak to that, too?
Oh, sure,
I completely agree with you, and the first thing that came to my mind when I heard that was, this is exactly how women who get raped or sexually harassed is we have to be very, very careful with our statistics and with our narratives before we start to say, because what is at stake is that we are saying this speaker has no credibility. And if you take away the credibility of people, then their political grievances cannot be heard in public. So I think one has to be extremely careful with that. There may have been one or two cases, but I've known cases of people who have never brought charges who tell me that they get spit on and insulted in New York City. We're talking in one of the most diverse cities in the country, and so I completely agree with you. And I would add to that, to answer the first part of your question, the way that I try to navigate the very difficult path of being able to say I'm free to not believe, and I respect people's rights to believe, and therefore I'm working for a secular government that would allow us all to coexist, is to really maintain solidarity with the oppressed. Because for me, as somebody who is very much influenced by the Enlightenment, it is the belief in universal values that also informs my life. So what you do on the ground, how do you promote artists from the area? How do you help the community and not just undermine their narratives, I would say?
So I just want to respond to that, because I actually do agree with all of that, and I'm not denying that anti-Muslim hate crimes don't exist. I'm not denying that women haven't been attacked for the hijab. I'm pretty sure they have. I've seen the environment out there. I'm actually a very, very vocal anti-Trump supporter. Anti-Trump guy. Anti-Trump supporter. So when you say that, you know, how do you stave off the rise of the alt-right, every once in a while I try to do a little bit of a purge, because I do get followers that I don't want from there. So I have to be very vocal about it to dissociate myself from that. So when I'm saying that these women who made up the stories, I'm talking about several high-profile media reports in Germany and France, in the U.S., and recently in Canada, that came out. And in most cases, just 5 or 6 of them, they turned out to be false. Right. So, and this is a problem, right? Obviously, because there are probably many, many more people who are genuinely attacked for it. They're probably a much higher number. Right? So whenever something like this happens, it does take credibility away from everything else. What I wanted to do is I wanted to look at why. The ones who did make it up, why did they make it up? And what my mother told me about that, you know, that her perspective, that if girls who don't want to wear the hijab, because there are many young girls, and all of these girls are young, like they're all 18, 19, this one was 11, that if they present it to their parents, if they say, well, if I go out there, I'm at a higher risk of being attacked by white supremacists, then maybe my parents will say, okay, you don't have to wear it anymore. So that's the perspective I was trying to... But I am not denying the fact that there's anti-Muslim hate crimes. And I agree with everything that you said.
Kind of on the heels of the hijab thing, I think for the Women's March, and I think even this organization, Humanist Hub, I remember I wasn't at the march with them, but I saw a picture with Shepherd Farley's iconic, you know, the woman, the portrait with the American flag, which I consider, you know, a powerful image of diversity, but not for empowerment of women. And I feel like I'd just like to hear your opinion on that, because it, to me, doesn't speak to empowerment all of women. Because it is used to oppress women in so many nations, and it becomes, and I feel like it's like we're trying to overcompensate by showing images like that at an event like the Women's March. To me, it has no place for the Women's March, but I'd like to hear what your thoughts are.
So maybe I'll take this one first. So as the only person, I think the only one here that used to actually wear a niqab, like covering my face, I actually really, did you wear it in Pakistan? Or?
Yeah.
Okay. I strongly identify as an American, not necessarily with our history, but as an American person. And so when I was wearing the niqab, I actually really liked this image because I felt like it helped to portray my perspective as an American but a Muslim. Ali Rizvi actually brought this up earlier, how hijab and niqab can become a political statement. And I can say for of the 5 years that I wore it, at least two or three of those years, I was simply wearing it because of a political statement. It had lost its original meaning for me, but it continued to do it, to cover my face because of the political statement I was making living in Texas as a Muslim. So, but I hear what you're saying, and I understand where you're coming from. I don't like the idea of it being co-opted by non, like from people from outside the Muslim community. I don't feel like it has a place among others. I think that as Muslim women or secular Muslims, and you know, bringing it up as to represent ourselves, that's one thing. But I don't like the idea that being shown by somebody who's like, excuse me, but like a white protester, you know, at the Women's March, because it's not their narrative, it's ours. And so I don't like it being co-opted, but at the same time, there's so much more to it than just, you know, it being a tool of oppression, because you can use niqab to liberate and you could use it to oppress. And it just matters about where it comes from, like if it's a woman's choice, if it's not. And I don't see it, I don't see the niqab in its essence as an oppression. It, even though you can see me now, I'm obviously not subscribing to what people see as hijab or niqab.
Can I add something to that? I think for me, that whole thing, that image, and Linda Sarsour coming out as if she's a spokesman, what I resent is not that they're in the march. What I resent is that they think that this covers the whole spectrum of how women from our communities identify. And then, to be honest, I fault us, because, wait a minute, she was out there, she's getting involved, she's organizing, and I'm thinking, what do we have to do to... And by the way, the vast majority of Muslim American women are not veiled. I think only 10% of Muslims, American Muslims, actually go to the mosque. And so it's the idea, I think, that liberals want to alleviate their guilt, and what ends up happening is they never, ever express solidarity with the full spectrum of people, right? And so I'll give you a very good idea, a good example. Like after 9/11, all the talk was, what are we going to do? How are we going to reform Islam? We have to reinterpret the text. We have to do this. Why did nobody ever come up with the very basic ideas? Hey, guys, let's strengthen the secular opposition. Why is nobody funding them? Why are our texts not being taught in the Middle Eastern departments? That's where we have to, you know, and so it's, instead of like just attacking them, we have to say, how do we get ourselves into position? You can't find an anthology of secular Arab thinking. You know, look at the catalog of the courses that are being offered. Things get disappeared. I have no problem with her being in the march because she worked for it. What I do have a problem with is people thinking that secular feminism in our community does not, that we're not all subscribing to apologist feminist text, and that there are real movements in the Arab world that are constantly being undermined because there is no political power and money behind it.
But isn't it because a secular woman who would organize a march will not identify herself as a Muslim? Like a secular woman. I mean, if Linda Sarsour was not wearing the hijab, no one would point out that she is a Muslim.
And that's a problem.
So what,
see, that's a problem.
A secular Muslim who would march for anything, she wouldn't have to say, I am, like, why would she say, I am a secular Muslim? And no one would know that.
You could say Middle Eastern, you know, it's like the Middle Eastern people for
but Middle Eastern,
well, I see that as the point of the organization, isn't it?
I think this
is a wonderful question, and I see it as one of the reasons why we're doing today's program.
I agree.
Yeah. So I just want to add to that as one of our one of the things that Muslims receive criticism for is the name. Many tell us why I don't want to identify with the name anymore. You know, I don't. They're not comfortable with the name secular Muslims or ex-Muslims, and we insist on this name at least for a transitional period that satisfies our purposes, our goals of the organization. We insist on not letting our identity, at least from a cultural perspective, be hijacked by others and speak on our name. Actually, there's one of our friends, Zainab Khan. She has an organization that was formed to fulfill that that particular goal to have representation of other types of Muslims. It's called MALA, Muslim Alliance.
Oh, yeah, I've heard of that.
Right. So I want to also mention a story, a personal story about the hijab issue. So I have a teenage daughter who chooses to wear the hijab. She identifies herself as a Muslim. She, you know, and she lives in Dearborn, so has a majority of Muslims in her school. And most of her friends are Muslims. So she grew up identifying with Islam. And when all her friends started wearing the hijab, she felt more comfortable wearing the hijab. So I support her with her choice. But I always feel it like when we're in a vacation in Florida and we're on the beach and I'm, you know, tanning and wearing my little short European
judging you. Yeah.
European, you know, and someone passes by and she's like all covered with, you know, with and it feels so uncomfortable and it's very hot, and they look at me like, look at this oppressive Muslim father who's just enjoying the sun and the beach while, you know, putting his daughter in garbs. And I see it, and then I was like, I can't explain right now. So it is kind of a stereotype. It is really her choice, and I empower her choice, and, you know, and if she's attacked, I have to defend her, and I have to empower her choice. She has to come to realize her own choices.
I guess the main problem was just the blanket use of that image as empowerment for women. I respect every woman's right to wear the hijab, but I do not think it's a symbol of empowerment.
So I wanted to, there's this thing I always get, like, why, as a man, why are you speaking about hijab? It's, and then I get some Muslim women a lot, and I always tell them, I'm like, the Prophet was a man, the four caliphs were men, the 12 imams, and the whole ideology from where the hijab comes was all based on what men prescribe. But so what I'm going to do right now is I'm going to quote my wife, or paraphrase her, and she actually made an analogy with the Confederate flag. So the Confederate flag in the South of the U.S., many people consider it a symbol of their identity, their heritage, and, you know, maybe they put it on their trucks. There are even black people who've written articles about why they, you know, they support the Confederate flag in, you know, governments and buildings and so on. But and what my wife says is like, okay, you have the right to fly your Confederate flag anywhere you want. Just don't forget the history and the traditional use of that symbol. Don't forget what it stands for. I think another good example is, you know, when you were talking about you didn't want other people to co-opt it, is with the N-word. You know, the N-word historically, obviously, is one of the most horrific terms of abuse and oppression that we know, right? Especially in the United States with this history. But many people in the black community have sort of co-opted. They've turned it around. They've used it as a symbol of empowerment. You hear that, you know, in hip hop music and everything. So, but they don't want other people to come and say it. So I think there's a difference between with the hijab defending the right of people to wear it versus celebrating and endorsing it. And that's a really key difference that I think people they conflate.
So my question is primarily about opportunities for groups like Muslimish or ex-Muslims or secular Muslims to educate people about Islam and take control of that conversation. Because whenever I go to events around Boston, you know, like by Islamic apologists, various organizations, it's always shooting fish in a barrel for them. They get stupid questions like, you know, does Taqiyya allow Muslims to lie to everyone? Does Islam promote terrorism and things like that? And it's very easy for them to shoot down these misunderstandings, genuine misunderstandings of scripture. And last year when Act for America graced us with their presence in the Boston Commons, you had the bigots on one side spotting these frightening talking points, and then the apologists on the other side saying, you know, no, Sharia law is all just like, you know, flowers and roses, and it's just like financial stuff, you know, don't have to worry about any kind of, you know, festive secularism. So it'd be great if ex-Muslims, I mean, I'm not one myself, but it'd be great if they could insert themselves right there and say, like, no, you're full of it, this is the actual, you know, this is the actual story, and take control of that whole thing.
I think that's what we're trying to do. And that's what we're talking about here, is making that distinction between. And the problem is that I think, you know, going back to your question about has the silence of secular Muslims contributed to this, the polarization that, you know, on the left, if you criticize Islam, you're a bigot against all Muslims. On the right, there are problems in Islam, that means all Muslims must be banned or profiled or, you know, whatever the case is. So, and that sort of middle voice, the voice of people like Raif Badawi, you know, the voice of people like the Bangladeshi bloggers who've been hacked to death in the streets of Bangladesh, you know, the atheists who are being hunted in Saudi Arabia and Malaysia, those voices, I mean, it's understandable why you don't hear from them. And you don't hear from them because they don't want to end up hacked to death in the street. They don't want to end up being imprisoned and flogged. Or even here in Western countries, people don't want to lose their families, right? They don't want to lose their communities. It's what they knew, it's what they grew up with. And it's a big cost. It's more than just changing your mind and changing your belief. It's, you know, there's a lot in, you know, what you spoke about. And there are examples right here of the cost, how high the cost is of just letting go of these things and what you have to go through. So, you know, that's probably why you don't see more people just getting in the middle and saying, you know, you're full of shit, as you said. But I hope that with this, if we have more events like this, if we have more organizations like Muslimish, and more of the dialogue and, you know, the way that what I was describing in my talk, I hope with that, and with time, more people can feel empowered. I know that there are a lot more now than there were before.
Or not necessarily insert themselves at that point, but like ex-Muslims conducting a class about Islam, spin-free.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, that is, well, you know, that is a kind of thing that I think is on the rise. Like, you're here, and I don't want to say, okay, ex-Muslims come in and they should overpower everything else. I just want another alternative. When I grew up, I knew that you could be a moderate Muslim, you could be a conservative, like Saudi-type Muslim. Those are the things I was exposed to. I didn't know this was an option. I didn't know there was an option where you could just, you know, not think this way and not have to choose the religion. I mean, that's not an option for most people. So I think when they start speaking up, you'd have the option.
Can I just speak to that very quickly? Mm-hmm. I think, just for us to keep perspective, in the 1930s, 3 years after Bertler and Russell published his book, Why I'm Not a Christian, there was an Egyptian fellow called Ismail Adham, who wrote a book, Limadha Ana Mulhid, Why I Am an Atheist, openly spoke about it. It was discussed in the press to the extent that, I can't remember the name of the author, somebody wrote a book saying, Limadha Ana Muslim, Why I Am a Muslim. And so if you want these debates to be bigger, another example I'll give you, Mustafa Mahmoud was one of the biggest TV preachers in Egypt in the 1970s. He was, for a long time, openly atheist. He talked about it, and he talked about his conversion from being a mulhid to a Muslim, which means that what we have to also do when we're thinking about these, we have to also look at the political context and the narrowing of the culture. And to be very honest, the incredible intervention and the incredible amount of petrodollars behind a particular brand of Islam. So there was a time in the Arab world right around when Bertrand Russell was writing that. And so I think one way to educate Muslims themselves, many of whom do not know about the pluralism within their own history, is to excavate these debates and these conversations and to say, look, this was happening between Ibn Rushd and al-Ghazali. This was happening in Egypt in the 1930s. There was another one, there was a Saudi one who started out as a Salafi. He was sent to study in Al-Azhar in the 1940s in order to spread the Salafi ideology in Al-Azhar. He got converted, he became an atheist and became an exile. We need to know about these stories. Arabs themselves, we don't have a single class that is being taught. I really will throw it out there as a challenge to you, all of you, if you can find at the graduate level, undergraduate level, a single class that talks about the history of these secular debates in the Arab world. We are being disappeared. You see, you're not just being disappeared by being shot and killed. You're being disappeared. I would like to ask Harvard, my alma mater. I was so frustrated. I could not be secular. I was afraid And I was stifled for so many years. Honestly, it's only now that I've found the courage, because I have a community to come out and speak. So we have to ask, who is funding all of these programs? Why do we have so many programs talking about Islam and human rights? Why aren't we paying attention to what secular people within the Muslim world? I'll talk about the Arab world because I know it. There are entire traditions and books and debates and conversations that are being disappeared. And that's where we have to start educating ourselves first, and then educating
others. To add to that, just really, really quickly, there is some resistance to secularism in the Arab world from what I've noticed from my correspondence with people, because there is also another association that people in the Arab world and in the Muslim world have with secularism, and that is dictatorship.
It's true.
So Kemal Atatürk, after the Ottoman Empire, last great Islamic caliph, Kemal Atatürk actually enforced secularism in Turkey. You've had people like Saddam Hussein, right? They would suppress religious people from getting too religious, and a lot of these people were secular dictators. You know, Egypt has a history of that too. There is a so they associate a lot of times secularism with oppression, which is why you see many times when these secular dictators, when they fall, like in Libya or, you know, in Egypt or in Syria, you know, Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood got elected.
But they do it rightly so. So, for example, Anwar Sadat, who actually put Nawal al-Sadawi, whom I was talking about, in jail. It's Sadat who was portrayed in the West as a very liberal and was feted and was really celebrated.
That's like the secular Shah of Iran.
The secular community is not aware of something really, really important. And he later on admitted that he made a mistake. He empowered the Islamist forces because for him it was a way to quiet and to co-opt the left, who did not like his open-door policy. And so he let them out and he strengthened them. He gave Sheikh al-Sha'rawi, they were on state television constantly. He was the predominant sheikh who was preaching. Nawal al-Sadawi personally said that this sheikh, who was kind of like the state-sponsored voice of religion, would speak and was in support of female circumcision. She begged to be allowed to go on state-run TV in order to be able to respond to this sheikh. And people in the West were not aware of it because to them, this guy was represented as the liberal. So, but he was actually instrumental in suppressing secular forces. So we have to be aware of how also, because in the Arab world, the state uses religion. So if you're not, if it's connected to the struggle for democracy and for really extending, and I think the arts, is if you fight for the arts and you cultivate the arts, that's where people's consciousness grows. But the government, but the arts are being defunded and being controlled. It's complicated.
I just want to make a quick comment because I'm going to, in a minute, leave you to very capably, I'm sure, moderate yourselves, because I need to go help my wife with my son. But just something on behalf of the organization as we're moving the conversation forward. One of the things I think that an organization like this can do, in particular in our work on campus where we are trying to educate a next generation of humanist and secular leaders, at institutions where people are going to be, you know, quite likely to go on and make a difference in the world around them, and also where we're working with faculty and other people on campus, is I think that we can commit to make this one of the issues where we move the conversation forward on those campuses, where we, you know, we're going to be creating programs, and I think that we can create ongoing programs among the students that we work with the faculty and the alumni of those organizations, that we can help inculcate discussions like this in classrooms and among student leaders, because I think there's a real ripeness for that, and so I hope that that's a concrete way in which we can keep in touch. I also think we should ask, you know, before too long, we need a good mother-daughter question. I ask questions for part of my living, and I found it intimidating to ask you guys a question because your story is so inspiring that it can be sort of overwhelming even for a professional interviewer to know what to say. But maybe, Huda, would you start with saying, you know, you're sitting here with us. What's something that you can tell the folks that are listening about your experience living with your mother, being part of this work, something that, that people didn't get a chance to hear about your experience or your mother's experience that you want them to know?
I think I want to add how, like, it, as a child, you grow up with your parent, and you know your parent from the beginning, and then, like, they know everything about you, but for us, it was a lot different, because it was almost like 9 years I didn't see her, didn't talk to her, didn't know who she was, and I had no idea, and all I heard was, like, bad stuff that my dad told me, that she was a bad person, she was not a Muslim. So, like, I imagined her to be this horrible person, and when I talked to her for the first time, it was just so crazy, and even when we, like, talk now, it's, like, sometimes I tell her, oh, remember when I had a pet duck, and she's like, oh, I have no idea. So it's just, like, there's so much stuff in my life that she missed out, and there's so much stuff in her life that I missed out on. And it's, like, crazy how religion can come into, like, religion just, like, if my dad didn't think of her as a bad woman, and if she had been able to get custody of me, like, I wouldn't have missed out on so much, and it just, like, my life would have been different.
You guys continue. This is wonderful. Just keep it going.
But just a comment to you. I just want to tell you that from my point of view, it's not the religion who did that to you. It's your father. And your father is one individual who follows that religion. And I just wanted to note to you that my question was not about the silence of the secular Muslims who are ex-Muslims. I'm talking about the secular practicing Muslims who are peaceful, not really fanatic, not Salafists, who are the majority of the Muslim world. And if they were up and speaking about their beliefs and that, I mean, I'm not sure if they really believe that the Quran says something or whatever, but even if they read it, they still think that this is not what they would practice. Maybe if they were vocal more in the West, then the West would have seen the Muslims not as one version, like one type, and more as a variety of different levels of practice, just like Judaism and Christianity.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So I'll tell you, I completely understand what you're saying, and here's how I think it works. Okay, so I do think that moderate Muslims do speak out a lot. Whenever now, anytime there's something like this, they come out, they condemn it universally. Almost everybody, moderate Muslims around, like throughout the U.S., even around the world, they say that we condemn terrorism. Everybody knows they don't like ISIS and so on. So it's not, I don't think that's controversial. Where the confusion happens is that if you have the average Westerner who's sitting there watching TV in the last 2 years, right? And you've had Nice, you've had Brussels, San Bernardino, you've had, Paris, all of these cities. There have been so many different terrorist attacks, and they've been done by people who said Allahu Akbar, who quoted the Quran accurately, too. I mean, they quoted words from the Quran that matched the actions that they were doing.
So the problem is that majority of the Muslim world is not Arabic speaker. I'm an Arabic speaker, and the Quran language is very metaphoric, old, complicated.
I understand that's a little bit of a tangent. Let me just stick with me for a little bit. So what happens is when they actually talk about, when ISIS actually talks about, you know, Surah 8, for instance, Surah Tawbah, or
sort of Tawassur and so when they actually talk about it, a lot of times the literal words that they quote, so let's say it that way, actually match the actions that they're doing. So when that happens, the average Westerner who's not really necessarily tuned into politics, they're seeing this, and they know there's only one common denominator. They know it's not race, because, you know, the underwear bomber was black, and the Jose Padilla was Hispanic, Richard Reed was white, the Boston Marathon bombers actually came from the place where the word Caucasian comes from. They were from the Caucasus, North Caucasus. So when they see all of this, they know there's one common denominator, and that's Islam. So they'll go to their neighbor, you know, suppose who are their Muslim neighbors who have been, they've known since they were kids. Their kids go to school together and everything. And they say, well, you know, what is this? Is this your religion? And then the neighbors say, no, this is not. You know, Islam is a religion of peace. Look at us. You've known us all your life. You know, this is not what we do. And they're being honest. They really don't think that that's what it was. And then they go and they read the scripture and they actually read it. They're not reading with tafsir. I mean, they're just, they got a paperback from Borders or Barnes & Noble or whatever the store is. And they read it and they say, well, is this true? Do you believe this is the word of God? And then the same neighbor says, yes, we do believe that's the word of God. It's infallible. But this has been misinterpreted, or the Arabic is wrong, and someone is reading it wrong, or this word actually means this, this word actually means that. And that, right now, it's, that's just not very convincing. So then you get this thing where people in the West just end up, or non-Muslims, not just people in the West, they start thinking, well, there's something wrong here, there's a disconnect. I'm not saying that they're right.
But the very tough language exists in all books. I agree with you. And actually, the interpretation, like for example, stoning, there is no mentioning of stoning in the Quran, but the Muslims still practice stoning and they refer it to Quran, but there is no mention of stoning. So what I'm saying is, like, why there is no more, like Islam and Bukhari, the scholar that is trying to not, like, trying to find reasonable explanation for the Quran, or like reform Islam, has no platform or no support in the West.
I don't think it's very convincing. So here's, I don't think that people who try to reinterpret scripture now, I don't think that's convincing anymore. And here's why.
But the people who interpreted the Quran, like when you talk about Sharia law,
the older
Sharia law is interpretation that might be completely wrong or half wrong. Like, why don't we debate that?
Yeah, but the problem, I think a better approach, rather than going with the interpretations of the verses, because, you know, you'll hear Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who is an expert in Quranic text, right? He has studied, he's got a PhD in it. So he's actually studying it. His interpretation will be very different from a scholar here, an Islamic scholar in the University of Toronto. So that creates confusion. I think a better approach is to start challenging the idea that it's infallible. To start saying it's not divine, maybe it's divinely inspired. Because the moment, that seems like a small change, but it's a huge change, because that allows you to be selective. It allows you to cherry pick. But right now, because what it sounds to me, at least when I was growing up, is when people say don't read it literally, all the apologists would say, this is the word of God, it's unchallengeable, Allah wrote it, the creator of the universe wrote it, but please don't read it the way he wrote it. Like, no, don't read it. Read it here, take this other human being's interpretation of it and see how they explained it. But the word of God. So I thought either that God didn't write a complete book, or he's a really bad writer. And then there's no other way around it. And this is the youth today who are on the internet, who are seeing all of this stuff, they are not convinced by it. It's just very, very difficult to... So we need a new approach, and I think challenging the infallibility of the whole text is a much better approach than trying to do interpretive gymnastics.
That's what Adnan Ibrahim was Adnan Ibrahim.
Oh, yeah.
Just had to give a new explanation to the Quran. But I think this is just great. That has happened to me. I learned it. And after that, I plan myself.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's the best way to become an atheist,
I think. I feel like part of part of this situation is the powerlessness of the Muslims, both in the ones in the Middle East, but in the ones here too. And there's only so much you can expect to have a platform and say things. At some point, you need to go and change things yourself or do things to have more power. And maybe, I don't want to sound like Malcolm X, kind of dealing with it, but there's, I feel like there's, we can talk, we can discuss things, but there are also things that can be done. And where do you see, what do you think Muslims can do in that way to actually empower Muslims, ex-Muslims, all sorts of people who are from those communities to live in a little more freer and better country?
Is this for a particular person?
Whoever.
Okay. I'd like to just touch on, I think that we can't just keep talking about the text as if the text existed in a vacuum, because you can have the most progressive interpretations, and we do. But if you do not have money and political power and states backing them up, they're meaningless. They're taught meaningless in the sense of changing, not meaningless intellectually. And so I think that apart from struggling for democracy and continuing to struggle for, and so if you look at the Egyptian government, the Egyptian revolution, for example, which has been aborted, there were two major demands that the revolutionaries had, and that was hukuma madaniya, meaning hukuma, a government that is a separation of religion, of mosque and state, but also a civil state that is not military. I think at this stage, what we have to do is we have to be doing the cultural work to prepare people to support the arts, to support science, to fight the tajheed in muqtama, the spreading of, you know, of sort of ignorance by constantly entering into these discussions. But the more you push for the arts and for the things that move consciousness forward, and you push for, we've got to lobby and push for, if this doesn't happen, the Arab world, the entire Muslim world, the Arab world is tearing itself apart. I mean, and I think the reason change is going to happen is because people are going to finally say, and people are saying that, including some religious clerics, we need a secular system because we're killing each other. Because the takfir, by the way, is not just you're a kafir because you don't believe in God. It's the Shia saying to the Sunni, the Salafi saying to the Ikhwani. And so it's going to come to a point where people are saying, this is not working. Curriculums have got to change, so we've got to push on that level. So I think we are at the stage now where we have to do the very serious cultural preparatory work to prepare ourselves as a people, and maybe stop worrying a little bit about what the West thinks about us. Because you know what it is? It's like if you have a child who's problematic, are you worried about what the neighbors are saying about you, or do you want to save that child? I think really looking at the seriousness of the situation that we are in, because you've got the two major powers, Iran and Saudi, who are equally crazy, killing each other, and we're sending them billions of dollars of arms. So your interpretation or my interpretation, who's paying those fighters? You can't look at the interpretation of texts separate from the historical context and what is happening, because these texts are used in a certain context to promote certain sectarian worldly interests.
I'd like to add to that, actually. So I think that we often underestimate the power of dialogue and of just talking. So one thing that Muslimish is doing actively is having meetings in which we just talk about who we are, what we believe, and it provides a space for people to question, to discuss issues that they often aren't able to in the general Muslim community. And by providing these spaces in the West, it's going to build, it'll allow for these spaces to evolve in the East. So it's just a matter of time before we're able to bring those, you know, back to our countries, our home countries, our ancestors' countries, and allow them to have those same spaces. But also, it's not like there's nothing happening over there. There's so much happening, but it's not covered in the West as much. There are activists, human rights activists, feminists, women's rights activists, and nonprofits. They're doing so much work on the ground. And I know most about Egypt because I lived there recently for a year and a half. But there's just so much work going on, but the government is suppressing it. So again, it does come back to a matter of power and ability, you know, what's what the states are allowing. And they came to this point where they actually kicked out a lot of nonprofits that they didn't want in the country, arrested activists that were speaking out, speaking too loudly, and, you know, disappearing a lot of these people. So we just have to keep supporting them, but that starts with on the ground and changing people, the general population, and allowing them to be more acceptable, accepting, and tolerant of others.
Do you have a question?
The lady has a question.
You have a question?
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's only the role of the imams to make a change. I'm wondering if it's the liberal thinkers in the Muslim community to be more outspoken. I mean, I just heard of you lately, but it seems like, I don't know if it's a Republican or a thing, the traditional people, they use propaganda not to brainwash, but the more you hear, you know, about your liberal thinking, way of thinking, I don't know how to make a, I don't know, what do you think? It's the role of the secular Muslims. I'm not sure if it's only the imams who can bring a change.
Yeah, one thing to add to both points that were made, that you asked why aren't the secular Muslims more involved? Well, that's a question that should be... We're activists, you know, obviously, but this is a question that I've always struggled with, because I was an activist when I was an Islamist, and I'm an activist now, and because I feel like what we have here is an example of the pains that are real, that are results of ignoring these subjects. So I feel the urgency of acting, but most of the secular community, and we have a struggle in general in recruiting active people who become activists. They, you know, the religious people, they have a huge anthology behind them that tells them, you know, this is the most important duty in Islam, which is, you know, propagating good, forbidding evil. If you guide one person, it is better than ما طلعت عليه الشمس, better than everything that's on earth. There is a huge anthology that this is the main thing in your life, is to propagate. So it's easy to recruit. The whole religion helps, you know, recruiting. But then seculars, how do you recruit seculars without feeling this urgency? This is not only a question for Muslims, this is a question for all, actually, non-profit secular work.
It seems like the liberals are almost like embarrassed to speak up more than the conservatives. That's how I see it lately. Like, the conservatives use a lot of propaganda against the Muslims, and it did work for a while, you know? And I'm not, you know, yeah.
Okay. I think there's a night. Identity aspect too. One of the biggest problems with liberals is that, you know, when it comes to if Pat Robertson says something, or if, you know, Jerry Falwell says something that's misogynistic or homophobic, and then, you know, they'll be like, this is terrible, he's a bigot, he's a homophobe, he's misogynistic, it's in all the headlines and all the liberal papers. But if the same thing comes out of the Islamic world, then they back off. They say, no, you know, we have to respect their culture, we have to protect... They don't speak up about it as much. And when that happens, then it's not about ideas anymore. It's about who's saying it. And when it's about who's saying it and it's not about ideas, that necessarily lends itself to identity politics. So I think that's a huge inconsistency as well.
Yeah, I was going to ask how you guys feel about that, because I think even in the West, it's not just, you know, of course it's extreme in the East, but in the West, we have this, you know, we feel this guilt that we need to demonize people like Majid Nawaz, the Southern Poverty Law Center, which so many people have so much respect for, you know, posted him along with Ayaan Hirsi Ali, you know, on the anti-Muslim extremist, and they, I mean, that was really, I mean, it actually their lives are at stake in some respect, but they also lost funding and that type of thing. Thankfully, I mean, he sued, and
They've taken the list down now.
They
took the same position that all of their. I know him personally, I know Ayaan too, and they get a lot of threats from Islamists.
Mm-hmm.
And what the Southern Poverty Law Center did in that case was they took pretty much the same position as Islam is, saying that they're anti-Muslim. So.
But that's problematic when you have someone, you know, especially, I mean, I grew up in Alabama, there, and like, as Majid speak about it, that, you know, they would be the same if anybody, any Christian person, you know, was, said anything that was bigoted or criticizing
Christianity.
Yeah, right.
No, they get Netflix documentaries out of it. Like, the people who leave Scientology are heroes. People who are lapsed Catholic, they make movies out of it. There's a whole documentary on Netflix about the three people who left Hasidic Judaism. It's called One of Us.
They don't allow the same kind of...
No, but if it's a Muslim who left their religion, then that it's not looked at the same way. You end up on one of their lists. So.
I think you had a question.
I have that one. Many.
Yeah.
So, say the liberal atheist and Arabs war, they can't speak up because if they spoke up, they would end either in jail or grave. So, I'm from Saudi Arabia. No one in my family knows about my beliefs. I can't even write anything on my Facebook profile. I can't even like a page that supports like ex-Muslims or anything like that. So, even like during your talk, even here I can't speak up. Like right now, since I can hear, I feel anxious. I have agitation because I have to go back home.
Right.
And each time I remember what can happen for me, it just scares me to death. But like I have no choice. So I understand why people they can't speak up there. They have
absolutely
no choice. Like Abu Hayri, we have Turki Hamid.
Right.
In Saudi Arabia, he is an amazing writer. He was put in jail 3 times. Raif Badawi,
right.
Many women, like, they speak up, then they have. It's scary.
It's scary.
Like, I feel I didn't have trauma in my life, but I'm living like a PTSD situation.
Right.
Just because I can't speak up. Someone can speak up. Like, I'm not optimist. Like, I feel maybe I'm very negative about it. It's easy to speak here in the West. It's
absolutely.
US, in Canada, in Europe, but like we don't have a choice there. I'm an atheist. Like it's in my blood. Like even when I worked in a mental health hospital in Saudi Arabia, I advocated for my patients because they were abused physically and verbally, and I was threatened, but not like physically. I had to leave my job because I was going to close my job because I just defended my patients. It wasn't about beliefs, about what it is, about anything like that. So it's...
Even in the West, I just want to indicate at this point, because I've talked about it in my talk also, is that even in the West, we do have many people who are under the pressure of their community. And it's very common in Muslimish for people to have two names. It's not a strange thing. Oh, this is, what's your real name? You know, what's your other name? And this is like my work. This is my like atheist name, and this is my Muslim name. You know, so it's very, very common. Like almost everyone I know has something like that. And some people have two profiles, and some people, have complete different lives. And that's in the West. So that applies to the secular movement in the West. But still, the vast majority. She's talking about secular Muslims. Why aren't they active? Like the moderates, they're not as active as the extremists, and that hijacks the agenda.
Yeah, I think the rise of the far right has also prevented them from speaking out as much. A lot of the moderates, because and this is one of the when people say, well, shouldn't you be allied with the people on the right now because they're taking up your cause and they're speaking up about the problems with Islam? And I always tell them, no, I don't. And the reason is that people who I know very, very secular, people who have moved beyond, they've assimilated, they've integrated, they are now going back and they're embracing tribal identities in defiance of the far right. And that's the opposite of what we want. And I always give the example of Fareed Zakaria, who you guys know. He's also from Harvard, and he used to be a wine critic. He's totally secular. I don't know what that is. I'll pick it up later. He's totally secular. And after Trump announced his Muslim ban, he wrote an article in the Washington Post that was titled, "I Am a Muslim." there. And he'd never really done that before. And then he said, I'm not a practicing Muslim. My beliefs are somewhere between agnosticism and deism. I haven't been to a mosque in 20 years. My wife is not Muslim. My kids are not being raised Muslim. But I feel I have to embrace this identity. And I'm thinking, when you have a guy like Fareed Zakaria, who's so powerful and so influential, and he's assimilated and integrated so well in American society, mm-hmm. and you're making him go back and embrace his tribal identity, what hope is there for all the rest of them? So that may be another reason that they don't speak out here in the West, at least, because they don't want to empower a lot of the far-right people.
By the way, Muslimish...
I really want to respond to what you said, because I found what you said so compelling, and mm-hmm. I have complete empathy, and I know that there are people at different levels of where they are and what they're able to do, and there are different circumstances in sort of different countries, and these are the things we have to sort of figure out, is how do we give people courage, and I think in numbers, because I know for a fact that I think Ali, in your presentation, that I think Saudi Arabia is one of the countries where this movement is the strongest. Egypt and Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, yeah.
So people are not connected with each other. It's going to have a lot to do with pushing for, you know, sort of democracy. You have so many, you have people all over the Arab world. In Kuwait, you have Nasser al-Dashti talking openly about al-Almaniyya, Durrat al-Almaniyya. You have in Iraq the Shia cleric, who is Jamal al-Din.
Jamal al-Din,
who is a highly, highly pious Shia cleric, who's saying, we're going to kill each other in this area. We're going to disappear if we don't finally have a secular structure in which to do it. So you. And to be honest, there are no easy answers. And we don't change society by not making sacrifices. And I think the real problem with the secular is not that they're going back and embracing secular identities. I look around me, to be honest, and I look at my community. What do they care about? The next vacation, the next car, the next McMansion. Oh, did your kid get into an Ivy League? Oh, is your kid in a brand name school? Oh, yeah. That's what they care about. And part of the reason that the revolution in Egypt failed, which was pushing for secularization, is it became very obvious, is because people, the elite, the secular elite, are selfish. And they would openly say, I want the dictator to come because I want to protect my lifestyle. I want to be able to go to the beach and my kids could go. They have not internalized liberal values. They like the perks. And so for them, let the stupid masses do whatever they want to do. We're going to the beach, to our resorts, to our closed communities. There is a spiritual crisis. And people are not going to change if they are not spiritually motivated, if they don't have a real value system within that they are willing to fight for. So courage, like I was saying, like in my talk, civic virtues. You know, being secular doesn't mean that you can't have values and spiritual to motivate you. You have to also believe and be willing to make great sacrifices. Like so many of the people, Farag Fouda was killed. Nawal al-Sa'dawi was on the hit list of the fundamentalists forever. She was now exiled. Nasr Hamid Abu Zaid, they also tried to divorce him from his wife. He had to flee. He was so heartbroken, he died early. It's a history of, it's a hard route.
So I have a question for you, Hannah. For example, I'm not sure if I followed, but you were talking about the many religions you were, or like sects you were part of at some point.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious to know what religion are you in now, or what status of the practice you are in now. And my question actually is, because I'm not an atheist, I'm actually a secular practicing Muslim, who is a very proud Muslim, but I'm a secular. It's not my identity, but I don't want to disconnect from Islam because I am proud of it. So I'm just wondering, like, to hear where are you now, and also for all of you, like, what is Muslimish? Is it? I get the feeling that most of you, I'm not sure, but I get the feeling that it's evolving about atheists or ex-Muslims. Would it be interesting for me to join something like this, because I'm eager for a community, but I also don't feel that I found what I need.
So I'm actually going to work around your exact question because I avoid answering that when I'm being filmed. When I joined Muslimish, I was a hijabi, and I was still very religious. And then I moved abroad, and I came back. And so I'm kind of answering your second question first. And I found the community I needed because it's so open and it's so diverse. So there are many of the active members are ex-Muslim or secular Muslim. But it's not an ex-Muslim club. That's called XMNA. So what I love about Muslimish is that it does provide you a community to be who you are, and you can be accepted for whoever you are. As for the first part of your question...
You don't need to answer it.
Yeah, I'm thinking of
my concern is the second part of it.
Okay.
And if you really know someone who thinks like me, I do practice. I'm just secular. I don't really care about the others, what they really practice. I respect every opinion, but I also I want mine to be respected, and I want to make sure that it's a place for me or not. I will find someone like me, or I will find mostly atheists.
I think it's going to depend on the particular community. If you're in Boston, I mean, this community is still new, so I can't speak about this community. I know in New York City, we're pretty diverse. My closest friend she identifies as a Muslim, but we go out and have a drink sometimes, you know, and we don't really talk about religion, but she has a stronger connection to that word than I might in the same way, at least. But then, at the same time, we'll go and talk in a group about, you know, debating hadith or what does this mean or what does that mean, and it can be very open, or it just depends on who you introduce to the community too, because communities are self-made.
The goals of Muslimish is to promote science within Muslim communities, to cultivate arts, to fight blasphemy laws in countries that have blasphemy laws. By the way, some states in the United States have blasphemy laws too. So fighting blasphemy laws so to allow a wider sense of freedom of expression, and to create a safe environment for dialogue where there are no red lines, where people are not afraid to speak their mind. So if you feel connected to these goals, then you'll find a lot of people who have the same purpose as you in the group. And I want to mention something just for the record, that Muslimish has made attempts, and that plays to what we were saying, to have some public figures, some celebrities, who we see them as a good candidates of being intellectually Muslimish, like Fariz Zakaria, like Asif Manvi, like Aziz Ansari, like who have expressed, this Iranian American Muslim, Maaz Brani, he even used the word Muslimish himself. He said, I'm Muslimish, you know? So, and Asif Manvi in his book, he uses very close terminology. And we've contacted some of them because at this stage we need some celebrity to bring some light on these subjects, but we haven't gotten responses. Now, we're giving them the benefit of the doubt, but we're saying that even secular Muslims, they have their reservations. They, you know, it might be complicated in terms of business, in terms of... And the general atmosphere, like the alliance of the... we don't want to get to politics, but the strong alliance between the Saudi government and the American government, you know, why is Asif Manvi never in the agenda? It is... the President of Canada has spoken, the Prime Minister of Canada has addressed the issue several times, but he's never been brought into the political light in America. There's a reason for that, and it has to do with politics too. So politics affect our also movement.
So you had a question?
One last question.
One last question.
How can someone promote secular and humanist values without criticizing their religion? I find it really challenging because I found it with a large Moroccan community group, and we promote those values that we find it very hard, and you know, it's almost impossible to promote those values without being attacked, because we have to touch into religion and How can you respond to this question? If you are an atheist and you refer to Islam, why are you still attacking Islam? Why can you just move on?
My answer to that usually
question, I think, is
that, no, why do
you? Basically.
Yeah, so I usually say, I'm like, why do cancer doctors care about cancer?
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
one of the answers. But apart from that, yeah, that's always fun. But what I tell people is, like, when they say, you know, why are you saying this? What's the argument? I always tell them that it's sunnah. Like, I'm just sitting here writing on a laptop, but, you know, the Prophet was... He spoke out against it so much that they chased him out of Mecca. When he came back, he actually destroyed all the gods. He was the original blasphemer. So all of these, anytime you want to bring a change, all revolutions start as rebellions. There's usually one person or two people who begin it. I mean, anytime you come up with a new idea, you introduce a new idea, you have to be prepared for backlash. It's never going to happen if you're... And the backlash, look at it as a symptom. Look at it as a good sign that means that what you're saying is actually bringing something. It's causing a reaction. It's causing people to react. And ask about, you know, why that reaction is happening. Explore the reaction. Embrace it. And it just gives you more opportunities for engagement. But I think that it's... I agree. I think it's when you talk about humanism and secular values, or even if you talk about science... You know, the moment you get into evolution, the Big Bang theory, the religion inevitably.
Yeah,
you can't do it. And then.
If you want to talk about human rights or women's rights, you can't be talking about women's rights without talking about how Islam supports women.
I'll give you one example of what you're talking about, and I think this is a really, really important point, is how. There was a case of in Saudi Arabia a little while ago. There was an 8-year-old girl who was married to a man in his 50s, and she wanted a divorce, and her mother was trying to get a divorce, and the courts had rejected it. Now, in a place where blasphemy is obviously has dire consequences, you know, you think about the avenues that you have. So, when people heard about it, there was a lot of public opposition to it. Right, you have people saying this 50-something-year-old guy marrying a little. Most Muslims were like, "This is disgusting. This is sick. This should not happen." But when you go to court and you're faced with the higher judicial council, which is like the Supreme Court in Saudi Arabia, and the lawyers go, they're like, "Well, you know, this is the Prophet did this. This is Sunnah. His wife was, you know, 6 years old at marriage, 9 years old at consummation, and he was 53 at the time." So at that point, either you have two choices. Either you can say, well, the Prophet was wrong, so this is wrong. Or you can say, no, no, what the Prophet did was okay, but maybe we should find a way to see if this is wrong, which is not a very strong case. So you hit this barrier. And you hit this barrier because when the religious reference comes in, then the whole issue just falls, it drops. So it is a big problem. If you speak out about it, you're going to get backlash. And you just... I think that's one of the most important things, is sort of figuring out how to engage with the backlash. It's never going to be smooth.
Okay, thank you guys for coming. I just want to say
thank you.
So we're going to have another conference in New York, June 23rd, in Hunter College, New York City. It's going to be a full-day conference. If you can make it to New York, we'd love to see you there. New York, we have a good group in New York. We have a good group in Detroit. I think we're going to have a really good group in Boston. I think we already have a lot of people in Boston. It's just about getting together and, you know, meeting regularly, which is, I think it's going to happen, and I think it's going to be a great group, and looking forward to seeing that group in Boston grow. Thank you so much for coming.